Deed, appearing on behalf of the appellant Pablo Santos Santiago. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Okay. Your Honor, Santos Santiago was denied his right to a fair trial when the trial court permitted the testimony of Joanne Mettler to give irrelevant, speculative, and unfairly prejudicial opinion testimony not only on Santos Santiago's guilt, but also on the credibility of the complaining witnesses in this case. This court should therefore reverse Santos Santiago's convictions and remand for a new trial. The briefing also discusses several challenges to community custody conditions. The state concedes that several of those should be stricken. Unless the court has any specific questions about those remaining challenges, I'm going to focus my argument on the improper opinion testimony.
I think we are interested in the condition related to dating relationship.
Sure. Very good, Your Honor. Well, starting with that then, the problem in this case with respect to that condition is that we don't know what dating relationship means. The interpretation based on what the CCO could interpret dating relationship to mean versus what my client's interpretation of dating relationship can mean is part of the problem here. It's vague. It's ambiguous as to specifically what that means. And that is the problem that we're alleging and challenging in this particular case.
It's really not in the same ballpark as Reeves, though, from the Second Circuit that you rely on.
Well, Your Honor, to some extent,
romantic relationship.
I disagree with some, in some respects with that, Your Honor. The problem in that case also dealt with a dating relationship. And, you know, in that case, it was characterized as a significant dating
romantic
relationship. A romantic relationship, pardon me. Here, you know, the argument is that romantic and dating, that doesn't cure the problem. We still have the absence of a romantic term here, but dating can mean several things. And the problem does not change just because the word romantic is missing. Simply sort of addressing and defining what a dating relationship means is the problem. For example, if Santos Santiago's met a woman for dinner but did not consider her a romantic interest or a potential girlfriend, would that be characterized as a dating relationship? What if that particular meeting occurred on more than one occasion? What if it occurred for a specific length of time? All of these create an ambiguity here that is creates the problem for purposes of Santos Santiago knowing specifically what is characterized as a dating relationship for purposes of, you know, either abiding by or violating this term. I'd like to move on just briefly with the few minutes that I have left to the improper opinion testimony.
One slight detour.
Sure.
On the use of alcohol, wouldn't the 2015 amendments that allow possession or consumption of alcohol kick in here? Wouldn't those apply? Those were in existence at the time of this sentence.
Your Honor, with respect to that change, possession or consumption effectively restrict the same sorts of things. And the intent behind that is to prohibit the consumption of alcohol, right? Possessing.
So if it went back on the use, the court would be free to impose possession or consumption?
Well, you know, I'm not going to answer that question. I think that requires the trial court to analyze specifically what statutory scheme applied at the time of these alleged convictions.
I guess that's the question I'm asking.
Okay.
Do you have any case that says we would not apply the conditions of community custody statute in effect at the time of sentencing?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
But addressing specifically the use thing, with respect to that being the condition, the problem here is that use implies several things. I mean, one can possess alcohol, rubbing alcohol, for example, without the intention of using it for a personal consumption basis, whereas the statutory amendments clearly indicate an intent to prohibit a possession of drinking alcohol, whether it's consumed or possessed, and keep that out of the realm of possibilities. Moving to the, unless the court has other specific questions, moving to the improper opinion testimony. Here, Joanne Mettler's testimony was improper for two distinct but related reasons. The first is that her testimony about generalizations about the characteristics of what sexual assault exams can reveal is entirely speculative. There's no dispute here that the complaining witnesses in this case did not undergo a sexual assault examination. Mettler was not asked to review their medical files in any sense.
How does that make it speculative, though? She's saying, in my expertise, a normal result can mean this, it can mean that, it can mean the other. Why is that?
The problem in this case is not that she's offering generalizations about what sexual assault, the process of conducting a sexual assault examination. The problem here stems in part from the fact that Joanne Mettler is being provided with hypothetical scenarios and being asked to draw conclusions based on those hypothetical scenarios, which in fact actually mask and mirror what transpired in this case. So despite having not conducted a sexual assault examination, despite not having reviewed the complaining witness's medical reviews charts, she's being asked to speculate what the cause of hypothetical injuries could mean in this case when mirrored with a hypothetical situation that masks and mirrors what transpired here.
I guess I'm not sure what question got to that level. It seems to me the prosecutor stopped as soon as he got his answer. It could mean no assault. It could mean an assault with no injury. It can mean an assault with an injury that's healed.
Well, that's one part of it, Your Honor. But this testimony respectfully did not stop there. After those questions, the prosecutor asked Ms. Mettler, hypothetically, if a 10-year-old was experiencing painful urination, what would you attribute that to? And then went through a specific set of factual scenarios that pertain to that, which ultimately led Joanne Mettler to come to the conclusion that, well, based on the factual scenario you have described, which, again, is what the complaining witness in this case testified to, that I would expect that to be more likely the cause of a sexual assault than opposed to something like a urinary tract infection, because that would require antibiotics to clear up. And so that's the problem here. It's not just a generalization. We have a generalization based on the specific facts of this case.
Isn't that what experts testify to?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of a case where an expert testified to a situation where not only did he or she not conduct the interview or the exam in question, but also, you know, is offering just generalizations about something that, you know, she has no personal knowledge of as it pertains to that case.
Well, I think 702 allows that.
Well, 702, Your Honor, for example, in the cases that we've cited, each one of those experts, the doctors or the treating physicians, specifically examined the complaining witnesses at issue and were able to draw sort of opinions and analysis based on those examinations. That's totally absent in this case.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ian Eath, representing the state of Washington from the King County Prosecutor's Office. We're asking this court to affirm Mr. Santos's conviction because none of the testimony of Ms. Mettler was improper. We are asking this court to affirm the community custody conditions except for those that I've noted in my briefing that we agree should be stricken. As to the issue of the expert, I won't dwell on it except the rest of my briefing and to point out that I think in this case State versus Kirkman really controls, where the testimony in State versus Kirkman was virtually indistinguishable from the testimony in this particular case.
Well, not as to the testimony related to the injury caused to the one of the victims.
That's true.
So why don't you address that? Because why isn't that an impermissible comment on credibility of one of the victims?
Well, first of all, the expert in this case was never asked that question.
Well, the expert was asked, as we just heard, hypothetical that was premised on testimony that would be elicited from the victim that was identical to what the victim, very close to what the victim testified to.
Yes, Your Honor, and as you well pointed out, Rule 702 accommodates that, and hypothetical questions are commonplace when you have an expert witness. I'd also like to note that because Mr. Santos didn't object at the time of this testimony on the grounds that this was improper opinion testimony.
Well, he did object. He did object to the admission of any of the testimony from Ms. Mettler. And so I'm not sure your waiver argument is well taken. So there's a distinction between the two arguments that are being made. And can you address the cases that are being relied on to distinguish 702 and what the testimony was in this case?
Well, First of all, our position on waiver is that he needed to make a specific objection on these grounds to develop the
record. What are these grounds?
That it was improper opinion or on credibility or guilt or the ultimate issue.
Well, he did make the objection that none of the testimony should be admitted because it was all speculative.
On different grounds. So, anyway.
How about the motion limine that was keep the experts to no opinions of guilt? Isn't that broad enough to cover this?
I don't believe so, but be that as it may, the testimony that the expert delivered was not a direct comment on the ultimate issue. So if you look at State v. Heatley, for example, or Hetley, there's a distinction between somebody who testifies about medical fact and somebody who says, I believe that the victim in this case is telling the truth and that the defendant is guilty of this crime. That's a very important distinction that our courts make. And if by extension, any time an expert were to offer an opinion on something that contributes to the ultimate issue, that is to say, if the expert delivers testimony that helps the state and leads to the conclusion that the defendant is guilty or that the victim is telling the truth, that would be an improper opinion. And that's not what happens at all. Our experts often deliver expert testimony about medical fact that allows the jury to add two and two. But adding two and two and getting to four does not make the testimony improper.
So you read the testimony, I lean towards the explanation that painful urination is related to an injury rather than infection because there was no medication provided.
Well,
this resolve is not an implied opinion as to credibility.
Well, the implication or the inference, if you will, is for the jury to arrive at. The question that was put to the same nurse in this case was, what conclusions can you draw from a report of painful urination? And the answer was, A, it could be a urinary tract infection, or B, it could be an injury. And then the next question was, well, then the expert may have even volunteered, I don't recall. She said, if it went away right away without any treatment, then I would lean toward it being an injury rather than a urinary tract infection. She was never told, the victim in this case said she had an injury. What do you conclude from that?
But that was the premise of the hypothetical.
Of course. But if you were to rule out such a hypothetical, then you would never be able to call an expert witness to deliver an expert opinion on subject matter germane to the ultimate issue, because the implication is always there. And such as in Kirkman, where you have a child victim and her credibility is necessarily front and center in the issue, in the case. As Kirkman instructs, the court has wide latitude and wide discretion to admit testimony that would tend to corroborate the child's testimony because it's extremely probative in a case of this nature.
So do you concede that Mettler's testimony corroborated the testimony of the victim?
Well, it certainly helped to, but that was the point. I mean, why else would you call the witness? I mean, to say that an expert witness assisting the state's case equates with improper opinion of guilt would to be nearly to rule out any expert testimony at all. Because if you were to call a witness because it helps your case, that doesn't make it an improper opinion on guilt. Just because she's a really good witness and just because her testimony clearly aids the state in getting the jury to guilty doesn't mean that she has directly opined that the defendant is guilty. Or
is this a new tactic on behalf of the state? I've not seen a nurse practitioner called to give this kind of opinion testimony before the victims testified. Is this a new approach?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't know how common it is. I can't comment on that because I don't practice in the sexual assault unit. But it's not unheard of as far as I'm told. Because I don't see why this is so novel, frankly. In any other case, you might call a fingerprint expert, for example, to say that just because you didn't find a fingerprint on the window doesn't mean somebody didn't touch the window. that is not an opinion on the defendant's guilt. It's just a scientific fact.
Well, she isn't rendering scientific facts.
Why not?
Well, I don't need to debate with you, but I don't believe that it's analogous to a fingerprint expert.
Well, the testimony of the nurse was that I conduct these exams, and I've done thousands of them, and what I look for is X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, but there was no exam here.
No, and she discusses what an exam can tell her.
Well, that was why the objection was to speculation, because there had been no examination by her of these two victims, and they had not been subject to an exam.
But our position is that the authority that controls here, just as in Kirkman, the doctor was asked, what conclusions can you reach from a negative result or a normal exam? And the doctor said, well, that doesn't rule out sexual assault. And there's very little difference here. The speculation that Mr. Santos wants us to conclude happened would have happened had the question been, this victim told us A, B, and C, what could that mean? That question was never put to the witness. So in this case, the jury can certainly infer it, and that's the benefit of the expert witness.
Before your time runs out, can you help us with what's the effect of the 2015 amendment on possession or consumption of alcohol? Does it apply to this sentencing?
In all candor, I looked this up and forgot to write the case down. But I believe that a sentencing condition cannot be applied ex post facto, and you have to look at the date of the offense. So I honestly believe that because the offense happened in 2014, I don't think that the statutory amendment would be able to be applied to Mr. Santos.
Well, before 2014, there was a statute, wasn't there, that the court could impose for consumption?
That's correct. So our position is that the use and consumption, given the context of the community custody condition, is virtually synonymous.
And well, since it has to go back, you could take out use and just have consumption if the court chose to do that.
If you chose to do so, we don't believe it's necessary. Thank you.
Can you address Kirkman?
Sure, Your Honors, I'd be happy to.
Why is this not like Kirkman?
Well, perhaps the most glaring difference here is that in Kirkman, Dr. Sterling's testimony dealt directly with examinations that he had performed personally on both complaining witnesses. And so he was allowed then to draw his knowledge and his expertise with respect to child interviews, sexual assault exams, to the facts of that particular case based on his interview. And that permitted him to testify, you know, generally to what the characteristics of a sexual assault exam or interview reveal when compared to what the complaining witnesses testified to or disclosed to him in that case. None of that is at issue here. We have entirely a hypothetical situation. And the problem is that basically allows the state to bring in an expert to say, we didn't conduct an examination, but even if we had, it probably wouldn't have shown anything. And had it shown something, then it was probably consistent with this hypothetical injury situation, which mirrors what transpired in this case. And that's the problem here. That's what defense counsel took issue with below. That's what we're taking issue with here on appeal, is that by allowing Joanne Mettler to testify not only about what sexual assault exams generally show in terms of injury, but then to apply that general sort of opinion about what they show to a specific hypothetical situation to which she had no basis in fact here. And as the state concedes here, you know, her testimony was not disputed. It was brought in to corroborate the testimony of the complaining witness. So, you know, there's really no dispute that this is prejudicial because it's allowing the state without the, you know, sort of factual basis to reach such a conclusion to nonetheless make one.
Is it unfairly prejudicial, though? Isn't the absence of evidence open the door to what's the significance of the absence of the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of responses to that. You know, that might be an avenue of proper witness examination on rebuttal, okay? And I believe it's Maul and Jones make clear that, you know, when defense counsel calls into question the absence of an exam or something to that effect, it's not improper for the state to call a witness or elicit some testimony in rebuttal. That hasn't happened here. This is a...
Did it happen at all? I mean, was there any implication after this?
Well, defense counsel's argument at trial certainly was that, you know, the complaining witnesses were not telling
credible.
The truth.
Right.
But that's different than simply calling a...
Why should the prosecutor have to wait to closing argument when counsel says, and they put on no evidence of an exam, they have no proof of an injury? It seems to me it's important that the jury not be given deceptive argument and that you cut off speculation about whether the injury necessarily did not occur because there's no corroborating exam.
Well, and then that would be an appropriate rebuttal for the state, wouldn't it, in this particular situation? If defense counsel is pointing to the fact that there's no evidence of physical injury here, the state can just as easily get up in rebuttal and say, well, that's because no exam was performed. So we wouldn't expect to have a result of an exam that didn't perform. But the state is effectively trying to nip that in the bud and say here that, you know, one wasn't performed, but here's what we would have liked it to show if it had been, and then tie that to this particular facts of this case. And for those reasons, we're contending that the testimony was improper, and we're asking that you reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you.